The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The employment report disappoints. Used car sales prices set to plummet. U.S. strikes back at Syria, and our guest today is R.C. Peck of FearlessWealth.com. All this and much more on episode number 504 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome back. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me today. We have a lot to talk about because there was a lot going on in the markets. It's April, second week of 2017. Already we're seeing some interesting changes in the dynamic of some of the economic reports. And we'll talk about that, discuss that a little bit more throughout this episode, as well as some of the things that we're seeing with regard to our military offensive that seems to be kicking off and gaining some momentum over the last few days. But again, thanks for joining me. Hopefully you had the opportunity to spend a little time listening to us in the past. If you're not a regular listener and you are a new listener, thanks so much for joining me. You could always get in touch with me by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and clicking on the Ask Andrew button at the top there and ask a question. We'll try to get it on the air, see if we can help you out. Of course, we have our various strategies. If you're interested in looking at them, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, which is a non-correlated investment strategy. We have some core stocks, algorithmic trading, as well as what we call alpha generation, utilizing some hedging strategies there. If you want to check that out, or the global allocations, or even what's coming with Investology, all on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So check that out. Make sure to see what's going on there, especially now that there's a little bit more confusion probably than we've seen in some time with regard to not only the economic circumstance, but also the outlook for fiscal and monetary policy. And maybe it's time to start thinking about what's going on with your portfolios. Well, let's step into some of the economics that happened in the week that just passed. We did see that, of course, on Friday, the all-important employment number came out, and it was, well, kind of disappointing in one regard, but on the other, it was quite exciting, right? So we saw only 98,000 new jobs were added last month, and there was expectations all the way up to about 200, but probably about on average, the consensus was probably closer to about 175,000. So that was a bit of a disappointment. Of course, when things disappoint, what do we get? Well, we get weather to blame for it. And that's just what happened here. That winter storm Stella may have held some hiring back over the last period when that storm, that cold front hit the Northeast. But we did see that. What was very interesting that even though only 98,000 jobs were added, we saw that the unemployment rate dropped to 4.5%. Now, what was really interesting about this was that there wasn't a change in the last month in the labor participation rate, something that we've talked about so many different times here about how the labor participation rate, people leaving the workforce, is actually helping and aiding the actual unemployment rate. But what we're seeing now is while the labor participation rate did not change, it was 63%, there was 326,000 people that actually left the employment rolls, and which is kind of interesting. I don't know why we didn't see this change in the labor participation rate during this period. But nonetheless, what's happened is that we are seeing that there is a 4.5% rate of unemployment, the lowest we've seen in a long time, which again pushes the Fed to probably continue on with their rate hike schedule for 2017. Now, we've also seen that there has been I think it's kind of fascinating the way that we're seeing that the ISM readings from a manufacturing base and also the non-manufacturing or services, which is a much bigger component of our overall economy, has changed. For a while, we did see that there was a nice rise in the services sector while the manufacturing sector was so-so. But recently, we saw that the manufacturing survey came out, and that was a little bit, it was interesting because it was higher and it came in pretty strong, while the services sector last week came in at 55.2. So services seem to be slowing down a little bit, which is a little odd. Manufacturing is picking up. Again, not known as a manufacturing country. We're seeing that with the new administration and with their, the whole Make America Great Again, and with the focus back on old school style and, you know, revamping and revising the steel industry and the coal industry and looking to roll back a variety of EPA laws that were put into place and all the things that are going on right now. What's really interesting is that manufacturing is picking up while services is slowing. Now, this is in the face of what you would expect to be a growing services sector, because consumer confidence that came out last week, and the Michigan survey that we said also we saw last week and the week before were peaking out. Now, why is confidence so good while sales and spending are down? Retail is seeing a lot of problems, but manufacturing is moving higher. It's a conundrum. I mean, it's a fascinating conundrum, and I don't think there's any one answer that really focuses in on that or could really explain any of this. So the other thing that happened last week on an economic basis that I thought was really probably one of the more interesting pieces of news that came out in some time was the Fed minutes. Now, this came out midweek, and according to the minutes of the March Federal Reserve Policy meeting, most FOMC members thought that the central bank should actually start to think about shrinking its balance sheet of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries later in the year. They noted that whether they decide to phase out or halt reinvestments may be an option, but the shift in the balance sheet should be, quote, communicated well in advance of any actual changes. So there is some talk about actually maybe not manipulating the interest rates with their actual Fed funds rate, but going into the whole idea of, well, maybe we're going to start thinking about reducing our balance sheet, which is something that a lot of traders and investors and economists and analysts had thought that was something that was going to be probably last on the list after they got through all of their rate hikes. They would keep their current balance sheet, all the treasuries and mortgage-backed securities that they owned, intact, let them run off naturally. And maybe this is just a start. Maybe this is talk. Maybe it's just a trial balloon that is being sent up these days. They like to do that. But markets were not too happy about this. As a matter of fact, as soon as that came out, there was an initial bump higher, because when you see the Fed does come out with any of their information, minutes or rate decisions or conferences, talks, speeches, there seems to be a uptick in markets. And I think that has to do with some of the algorithmic tradings that are keying off any kind of Fed speech. But right after that, markets did a reverse. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest reversals to the downside of any day for about the last 14 months. Things were doing pretty well during the day until this happened. Then again, it could be also that reversal blamed on Speaker Ryan, who right about at the same time started talking about how the House maybe had some kind of a tax plan they were working on, but the Senate really had nothing that was substantial or anything that could be even reviewed. And the White House had nothing either. So now all of a sudden, Paul Ryan's out there talking about how there's really no tax plan that could be put on the table anytime soon, taking that whole idea of an August timeframe off the table, and possibly even 2017 off the table. So now when you add the commentary by the Fed and you add this commentary by Speaker Ryan, markets are all of a sudden a little jittery. Now, to put a cherry on the cake, what happened next? What happened next was, all of a sudden, 59 Tomahawk missiles were fired into Syria during the luncheon with the head. When President Trump was having lunch with the Chinese premier, all of a sudden, 59 Tomahawk missiles are being fired or something. You know, there's this, during this whole visit, this is going on. So when you add these together, it was no mistake that the VIX started to pile on and attract buyers. And we saw that markets were not in the best of moods. As a matter of fact, when you look at the week, they pulled back slightly over the 5 days. The Dow lost about 0.03%. The NASDAQ and the S&P had losses of, let's see what we got here. The S&P was down about 0.3% and the NASDAQ was down 0.5%. The Russell 2000, the small caps, moved down by 1.5%, and the VIX was up 1287, about 4.5% for the actual week in total. Now, we do have, starting next week, some things that are important. This is when we start seeing some of the major earnings reports from important players. Now, of course, on Monday, we have Federal Reserve Chair Fed Yellen is going to be discussing monetary policy at the University of Michigan. Okay. But starting during the week on Thursday, we're going to have earnings from Citigroup, JP Morgan, PNC Financial, Wells Fargo. We'll see the March producer price index. Not a big week for economics this week coming up. Preliminary April confidence from the University of Michigan is also going to be coming out. We're going to be seeing some other information. I think Friday, we're going to be seeing markets, I think, are closed on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. It's going to be Good Friday. All in all, there is, I believe that's the, I have to check that, but I think the markets are closed on Friday into the weekend. By the way, happy Passover, happy Easter. We'll talk about Easter maybe next week, but happy Passover to all of our Jewish friends out there. And of course, Good Friday's coming up. So a lot of good holidays coming up. Hopefully you'll have the opportunity to spend it with friends and family coming up shortly. The things I do want to talk about very quickly before we get to our guest today, R.C. Peck, is, I mean, a big question is, are we going to war? We do see that there are ships on the way to Asia right now. And there was a big naval force that is being, I don't know if it's going to be just chest thumping or if this is aggressive actions in any other way, but seemingly we're all of a sudden putting ourselves in a position that I thought we didn't want to put ourselves in, which is now back to being the world cops, the protector of people, which is important. Obviously, it's something that we can't let these gas and these deadly gas attacks go on. Without any kind of response here. But, we're seeing what we've seen so many times before when a new administration gets in and all of a sudden the players around the world try to fluff their feathers and to see just what the response would be. And we're going to have to see how markets handle this, whether it's just something that passes very quickly and is transitory or if it's something a little bit bigger. Now, one of the things you may want to do here, and what we've done for our clients at the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, and I've done actually even for myself as well, is to add some VIX exposure. Now you can go out to May, pick up the 17, 16, 15 strike on the VIX on the call. There may be the opportunity to see a significant amount of volatility due to many of the things that are circling right now. Again, the question about what's happening with healthcare, the question what's happening with tax reform, if anything, in the 2017 year. We have earnings season starting, not to mention these military maneuvers that are going on. There could be a lot of concern there. So think about that. I'm going quickly because I have a lot of things to talk about here. There was a great report out by, it was Capital Economics. They put out this very interesting discussion about the weakness in auto sales. You know, we have seen that there has been a bit of a rolling over of auto sales. In particular, the biggest concern with a lot of people right now is all of the cars that are coming off of lease and into the used car pool, if you will. And the prices on used cars are set to really have some significant pressure over the near future. They're already starting to roll over a bit. We've seen that companies like Ford and GM, CarMax, AutoNation, and like some of the funding sources like Santander Financial, these companies have seen a lot of pressure and a lot of concern. And Capital Economics said, well, you know, maybe some of this is a little bit less alarming than it seems. They go on to talk about that there's some offsetting areas in this. But when you look at the bottom line, you look at the charts of what they're presenting here, it clearly shows that there has been a significant roll of the car prices, both new and used, and new motor spending that's going on. There's been a precipitous decline in 2017, the end of 2016, and into 2017 on used vehicle spending. Now, we've seen a flattening out of new car spending as well, and a lot less. We know that there's a lot more incentives that going into play and a lot more haggling, we'll call it, that's going on by buyers. So it's clearly a buyer's market right now for cars. And with even the interest rates popping up a little bit, we're seeing that there is a tremendous amount of inventory that is being added to the car lots. And this is something that we've seen before. The question is if it has a much broader indication of the economy. We know the consumers generally, we've seen it, you know, in many different series recently, the consumers are just not spending on certain items. I don't know if it's anything more than just a change in the culture and what they're doing. Maybe they're, buying bicycles and motorcycles over cars possibly, but, you know, and they're going after used cars because it's a much better bargain available for the used car market versus the, and because of all the cars that came off lease. And not to mention, we talked about this about a year and a half ago, or possibly even 2 years ago, that as we saw the expansion of the lease and buy terms, so in other words, we went from about a four-year average on a car loan, and now leases came on, and when car loans went to four, then five, and six, and 7 year on average to buy a car, and all of a sudden we're going to see all these people buying expensive cars because they can amortize it over a much greater period of time, and all of a sudden what will happen in the end when all of a sudden these things roll off? And as we saw the new cars sales climbing, realizing that this would one day turn into a used car sale, what we're seeing is that there is a ramification for all of these bargains that were made, and in kind of a deal with the devil that the car companies were willing to do in order to make car sales continue. So watch the used car market for a little bit of a tell on economic activity and consumers. I think it's very fascinating what's going on there. So anyway, keep that in mind, something that you have to, I think, keep on the front of the potential for how consumers are operating, you know, especially in times of confusion. And, while we have a lot of good things potentially on the docket for the future, something is hanging out in the background that doesn't seem as great as the sentiment really appears. All right, so let's kind of get on over to our guest today, why don't we, and see what he has to say. And our guest today is R.C. Peck. He is the founder of Fearless Wealth at fearlesswealth.com. Also, the host of the weekly podcast with the same name, Fearless Wealth. And we're going to talk to him about a variety of things. Hey, R.C., thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. It's great to be here.
So listen, I wanted to first, let's kind of start off at the beginnings, because you're one of the guys that have been around for a bit, not an old man by any stretch, but yet you've been kind of dealing in the area of education and markets since what, the late 1990s, which again, is not that long, but it's long enough that, as opposed to some of the folks that are a little bit newer. Tell me a little bit about your story.
Yeah, so, I kind of come at this from I have a contempt of Wall Street point of view. And the reason is because I was introduced to investing by finding out my parents' life savings was embezzled. So that was kind of one of my first introductions to
a big wake up call.
Yeah. I didn't need to wait until the global financial crisis or something to find out that we are being misled. So, you know, I came into it kind of like a financial heretic. I wanted to question, I wanted to be able to choose. And in the 90s, what I found was people didn't want me to choose. They were just saying, no, this is how it is, son. This is how it is, kid. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I think that's what my parents chose and it didn't work out. So I was just lucky enough or fortunate enough to get a really high paying job out of college. I worked in Asia for a few years. And so I was able to sponsor myself in my 20s, which was the 90s, and just basically say, what really works? I want to know what really works, not what sells best or what worked best in the 1970s, but what is best today? I want to know what's best today because I had saw what happened. So I kind of came from that point of view of being super skeptical, but not cynical. And that's what started Fearless Wealth.
I mean, you know, the thing is that, I mean, obviously we know that your situation was one that is not common. It happens, right? It does happen. Embezzlement happens. I'm not talking about bad management now. I'm not talking about people that don't know what they're doing. I'm not talking about just careless kind of things. I mean, we're talking about, when we talk embezzlement, we're talking about stole their money. That's what we're talking about, right?
Correct.
Okay. That's a whole different genre than people not knowing what they're doing. I think you'd agree with that, right? So you come in with the whole side of, you know what, wait a second here. Now my money's not even safe, even if the guy is qualified to do this. So you're starting off very jaded. You're starting off with a level of, you know what, I don't want to be in the same situation where this, I don't want to ever be anywhere near that situation. So I get that. So you started with then learning everything that you could learn, right? You started what, in the commodity pits?
I mean, even before the commodity pits, I literally bought everything I could, right? So this is pre-internet, pre-Netscape IPO. I mean, I would buy stuff off the TV, magazines, newspapers. It didn't matter. Like, you get the old clamshell with the cassette tapes, and I'm like, I'm going to figure this out.
Okay.
And in doing that, I was like, oh, well, look, there's like all these different commodities. Some of them are always making lifetime highs and lifetime lows. The stock market doesn't make lifetime highs and lows that often, historical. Like, oh, I'm going to go learn in the pits. And I just, for whatever reason, is more arbitrary than anything else. I started in the coffee, sugar, cocoa exchange and just to learn about the emotions and the movement and whatnot. So yeah, that's where I started it. I mean,
That was like shock therapy. I mean, that was not, you know, talking about throwing yourself right into the icy pond to figure out what it's like to swim.
Oh yeah. It was like dog years, right? Yeah,
so exactly.
10 years of stock market investing is like 1 year of commodity investing. So I was able to accelerate, you know, my learning.
So you learned a lot and you still to this day have a bit of a rough edge regarding the world of traditional brokerages, we'll call it, right? You haven't changed your tune on that.
You're right about that. There is still that rough edge.
Right. So, and still a mistrust of the, let me ask you this. Do you have a mistrust of the system, or is it mistrust of individuals, or is it just, where is that, you know, where has that led you?
You know, I think, when you said the word trust, the first thing that hit my brain was Ronald Reagan, trust but verify.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the word trust to me is dangerous. Like, my clients trust me, of course. Like, you hand someone money, they have to trust you. But what I found is the leading investment strategy is I trust and like fill in the blank. And so the first thing was, oh, that might not be the best strategy. As far as the system, like the system of the stock market or the bond market or the commodities market, completely have faith in that. When people say to me, oh, it's being manipulated, I'm like, yeah, that started about 5,000 years ago when gold was being, like, the idea of manipulation is as old as gold has been being used to, you know, get you across the river, the country, whatever, to, you know, clothes on your back, food in your stomach. So this idea of manipulation being new, I don't take, and I don't have the same feeling that, oh, manipulation is now going to take the market down. Like, I consider the market to be incredibly good at filtering out the garbage.
So what you're saying is, just to summarize this, is that generally speaking, the system itself is solid and it has an underpinning that you believe, an underpinning that you believe is one that you can have some faith and trust in, that you could actually be a part of. However, there are individual components of the market vis-a-vis maybe some advisors or brokers or maybe even brokerage houses that you would say, you know what? That's where some of the problems could lie. Not that it's going to topple the markets or anything like that, but that's where, when you get down to the granular notion of who's individually involved, is where you need to be skeptical.
Yeah, the markets itself, great. I think they are well, run system, because there's hundreds of millions of people in there. When it comes to, okay, how do I position my money for me? Right, which then you involve traditional advisors. Then I think the system is not aligned for what's best for the individual investor.
Now let's talk about some. So I brought this up because it's interesting. As I was listening to your last couple of podcasts, again, you can grab RC's podcast over, I guess, on any, anywhere the fine podcasts are offered. But basically, just look up Fearless Wealth or just look up RC Peck. Basically, you had a couple of, I call them rants, on a particular one person, which is just like we're talking about it, where the markets may be efficient, the markets may be acting well, but you have some issue maybe with some of the individual areas. And one of the things, I just talked about this last week on the DH Unplugged podcast, and you talked about, you focused in really hardcore on Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins, who historically has been the motivational speaker, the coach, life coach, and all of a sudden, over the last few years, Tony has been very much involved with the idea of money advisory, we'll call it, financial advisory. So I was surprised because he was talking, and there was a major, very clearly in the last week or so, a major full court media push on Tony Robbins saying something to the effect of, don't fear a market crash. And the headline made you believe that he thought there was going to be a market crash, like he was calling for a crash. But when you read the subtext, it was all about, hey, these are the things you have to do in order to protect yourself and, diversification and a variety of things. And I was just scratching my head saying, when the heck did this guy get involved in the markets? And what qualifications does he have? And you went on a variety of things that he's been quoted as saying, and kindly pretty much saying that he's been spewing a tremendous amount of misinformation. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So
without making your blood boil.
It's too late.
Okay.
I have like 12 points I need to go after Tony on. I only went after two in the last 2 weeks. So, okay, look, Tony, I need to set this aside. So Tony, empire builder, Tony inspirer, Tony motivator, Tony helping people. He's the why guy, why people do. So let's just set that aside because he is amazing at that. I am not at all, quote unquote, attacking that.
Okay. Yeah.
Tony has now saying, okay, I'm going to figure out this whole how to keep and grow your money. Okay. And he eventually partnered with Peter Malouk. So what has happened is he is disrupting the marketing end of money management. He is disrupting the marketing end of money management, but the actual business end of it, it is the same 1970s approach. Like nothing has changed, but people don't know that because they hear Tony Robbins and they go, oh my gosh, this is the guy that has figured things out. Like he's the guy who disrupts all these other areas. And now he's focusing on disrupting how to grow and keep your money. So, and he knows how to do it the right way. By the way, Tim Ferriss is failing in the exact same way too. But so people are hearing, oh my gosh, Tony Robbins is the guy who figures it out. But what's amazing is he didn't figure it out. All he did was disrupt the marketing end of it. And now that he's a business partner with Peter Malouk, he is biased. And what's just amazing is he completely missed it. So I'll just point out a couple things, and you may need to interrupt me because, so one of the things he said was, if you don't sell, you don't get hurt.
Yeah, that's such, I'm going to say the word hogwash, but.
And the level of garbage around that. Now, his point is, hey, the market always comes back. Guys, of course the market always comes back. But if you're 60 years old and it's 2008 and you believed that, all right, and you had even your money in a 60-40 split, your money still fell by 40%. Now, I'm willing to bet that 60-year-old did not know what he was getting into and how hard his nest egg could fall. And 2 years into a five-year correction from a time point of view, he's not going, well, Tony says if you don't do anything, you don't get hurt. That guy's absolutely hurt emotionally, spiritually, financially, right? Because he gets back to the start line when he's 64 or 65. So the idea that you're never hurt if you don't sell is complete garbage.
But are you then espousing or even thinking about the idea that market timing is a better solution? Or are you just saying that him throwing this out as a way to try to entice you is just a very misleading, and it's a misleading prospect of how to handle your emotions, handle your money, and that, you know, the markets will always go back up. I mean, there have been times, there have been decades that money's been dead.
Yeah, it's called the 1970s.
Right, yeah, back to the 1970s, right. So
or the 1930s. So I mean, it's two things. Like, yes, that's at best, it's misinformation, right? It's not, I mean, in the court of law, is it true? Yes. In how we actually live through life, is it true? Absolutely not. Of course that person's hurt. Because remember, 2008, and I know you know this, wasn't the first time the market fell, you know, more than 49%. So, you know, so you have these people getting hit again, the second time in a decade. So the idea that if you just do nothing, so that's the first thing, because it's not just the getting the money back, but if it takes you 5 years to get back to break even, you're not, you know, 60 anymore, you're 65. And a five-year difference for a 60-year-old or going, you know, 70 to 75 could feel catastrophic to someone. So he completely eliminated the idea like, oh, it's going to take you 5 years to get back to the start line. So that was one of the things. You then asked, you talked about market timing. I have a lot of feelings around that. So I have two points of view. If someone believes they should never, ever get their money out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First of all, I don't believe that. But if they believe that, then I can go down a whole line of this is the best way to do it. But what I've noticed, and let's just call the market the stock market for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't believe someone should always be in the stock market. I don't believe that. Because when I did my research in my 20s, but it was the 1990s, it doesn't say the same way, but I'm dyslexic. So the way I learn is visually. I have to look at images. I have to look at pictures. And so when I was teaching myself in my 20s, I was learning through images and pictures, not through hundreds of pages of data. And what I noticed was, well, the image doesn't fit the words, like the never get out. And then I see an image of, you know, 1965 to 1982 and go, oh my God, the market did nothing for basically, you know, 18 years. Well, that's not a time where I wanted to be in stocks.
Mm-hmm.
So I do not believe what's best for people's money, that they should always be in the stock market. I do not believe that.
So, but when would be the time that's not appropriate to be in the market? Like, in other words, how do you know?
So it's a great question. What I did and what I figured out was I said, okay, so let's say there's period. Let's just presuppose there's periods to not be in the market. The first thing I want to know is like out this week, in that week, out this month, in that month, out that quarter, in that quarter, out this year, in that year. So what I found was it wasn't like this daily or weekly or monthly or quarterly or yearly thing. What I noticed was in researching this visually was, oh, like you're in like for years and years and years and years and years. And then there's this like 2 or 3 year period that can potentially be very, very dangerous. So the first thing you noticed was that it wasn't this in and out, in and out, in and out thing. It was like, oh, when you're out for, you know, 18 months, 30 months, right? It wasn't an in and out. So that was the first thing I noticed. The second thing I asked myself was how can you tell there's a curve coming in the road? Like, are there certain things that happen, you know, when the road curves? And let's say a road curving is 20 to 50% correction in the market. And so I just said, well, what has to change to say maybe something has changed? And what I noticed was the flow of money. All right, so one of the first things I noticed was, well, before that get out of the, let's just call it a get out of the market call, okay? Let's just say before each one of those, the amount of money flowing into the bond market relative to the amount of money flowing into the stock market always changed, right? So money's always flowing into the stock market, money's always flowing into the bond market. But what if before each, you know, painful correction, money started flowing more and more, relatively speaking, into the bond market, which is actually true. That's what has happened before each correction. It's like, oh, there's a tell, right? So what is it about the tens of millions or the hundreds of millions of people collectively around the globe who are saying, something's off a little bit. I'm just going to put an extra dollar into the bond market than the stock market, or I'm going to change things slightly. But you take that collectively with tens or hundreds of millions of people, and you're able to look at it visually. And then it starts to show you, hey, something is different. Something's going on different here. So when you ask that question, the answer is, I look to, well, where's the money flowing? My answer to that question is, I look at what prices are changing to other prices, relatively speaking.
Well, the problem with that, let me just interrupt you. The problem with that is over the last couple of, or last several years, that has been highly distorted due to the fact of central bank action. It's been highly distorted because we're in a low inflation environment. And again, with central bank action that is supportive of bond purchases and implicit and negative interest rates and all that. So I don't want to say, quote, this time is different, but there's definitely a change in the ability to utilize that strategy in order to figure out what's happening, because we know money's been flowing into bonds and out of stocks. It's been going on for a while now. But again, isn't it a very difficult thing to pick up on? Well, first of all, if we use that as just a standardized situation, maybe that wouldn't have worked out very recently too well. But isn't things a little bit different right now?
I mean, the way I'm measuring it, no.
Okay.
Since 2009, more money, again, my definition, more money has been flowing into the stock market than the bond market. Again, the way I measure it, that has not changed.
There's been no lapses in that where it started to lean towards bonds versus stocks since then?
No.
Really?
The way that I measure it, I use it's so if I what I learned was if I just use one signal, that one signal half the time it says to do something is false. So I was like, oh, one signal doesn't
right.
really
so,
work.
So you need confirmation.
Yeah. So I need confirmation. So when I added, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? Like extra signals, the way I measure stock or bond, that has not changed.
Interesting. I'm not going to ask you to give away your secrets here, because obviously that's something that I'm assuming that you hold close to the vest on how to figure that out. But I'm just a little bit surprised that over the last few years that there's been this very strange distortion. We do know, I mean, obviously there has been flows, but, you know, and not to mention the interesting way of the ETF markets that have been also acting a little strange here. But I thought there was I could remember a few times by the way that we look at stock and bond flows, that there has been a few different scenarios. Back in 2011, there was some in 2015 and part of 2016 in the beginning, that there was a seemingly a pretty significant reversal of stock versus bond flows.
Yes. So, I mean, I'm looking at the price chart right now. So, yeah, I mean, in 2011, we had the debt ceiling debacle or whatever it's being called officially, where the market almost closed down 20%. Mm-hmm. There was a period of time where more money was flowing into bonds than stocks. So at that one signal, just if someone just asked that one question, then that answer would come back, yes, more money is flowing into bonds than stocks.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
So if it was just that one question with no other, is this false?
No confirmation, no additional confirmation. I got you.
Confirmation, then, you know, someone would have got into that and then gotten out. And what I'm looking to do is not to be right over any individual year, but say, has the bigger trend, has it really shifted or changed?
I got you. So you're using a very long, I'm not going to say moving average, but a long time frame, very long time frame to see how the overall will change. Now, here's something interesting. So do you have any concern that your I'm seriously asking this. Do you have any concern that your signals may get a little weird in that the evidence of central banks backing off bond purchases and the potential for interest rates being at, you know, near historic lows, negative interest rates could cause a problem in your next signal?
Here's the thing. I'm always assuming there's a problem I say that like earnestly or honestly, like I'm always assuming, okay, how is it wrong? Like we all fool ourselves, even given what you and I do, like how am I fooling myself? What am I not seeing? Is there a change in ETFs? Is the you know, the low interest rate environment, how is this changing it and or not changing it? So I'm not going in saying this doesn't ever get adjusted or changed or whatnot. I mean, I'm looking at both of those assets separately too.
Right.
Right. So I'll look at a 10-year treasury, just a 10-year treasury, not an ETF, but just a 10-year treasury, no dividends reinvested, like, you know, the 10-year U.S. treasury. And I'll just look at that standalone and go, oh, well, it's been going higher for 35 years. Okay. Over the last 5.5 years, it's been in a sideways trend. So over the last 5.5 years, the price of the 10-year treasury has gone sideways. 5.5 years. That's pretty significant in a 35-year upward trend. So my question then is that a topping or is this a digesting and it's moving higher? I don't know. But I look at each asset separately. Same thing with the stock market. I'll look at the S&P, SPX, without dividends or investment. I'll just look at that separately and go, is that itself in an absolute form trending higher? And if you look at both of those, you see the 10-year treasury is going sideways for 5.5 years and the S&P 500 is trending higher. Without comparing those two or looking at funds of flow, but just getting to the actual price movement. So to me, the bottom line is price.
Yeah, right? As my friend Brian Shannon always says, it's only price that pays.
Yeah, so ultimately I'm looking at the price and saying, okay, well, look, the price of the S&P is still going higher. Who am I to say it shouldn't or should? And whatever the historic P/E ratio is and, you know, fill in the blank of whoever's fear-mongering something. So I look at those in silo terms and say, oh, okay, what's going on? And then I compare those two prices and I say, okay, which price is doing better on longer periods, not any day, week, month, or quarter, or even almost any year, but like on a longer saying, okay, which price is protecting people better?
Right. Well, let's get back to Tony Robbins for a second here. And so how is what he is doing? You said he's disrupting the market and the marketing end of the money management business, but he's still in the 1970s in terms of his investment advisory model. I think that's what you said.
I did.
What's the problem here? I mean, is he basically just using his clout and his popularity that has been involved with all of his other things and just sticking a front end on from a marketing standpoint and just trying to bring money in? And if so, if he has a decent money manager behind him, it's not the worst thing. So he's like a paid advertisement for this, right? But he also seems to be, as you mentioned the word fear-mongering a little while ago, he's kind of putting a lot of fear-mongering in, but at the same time saying, yes, we know this stuff is going to happen, but we have a way of essentially protecting you, right? Yeah, use us, right?
We've got a special system. We've got something magical going on. So here's my problem. He is standing up and saying, I'm going to stand up for what's best for your money. I did the research. I interviewed the top 50 money managers on the planet. I got access that no one's ever had access, and I found out how to do it. I found the answer. And if he had then said, look, you're never really going to beat the market. This thing is amazing how it can digest information. And you as a human, we're so flawed and we fool ourselves that, look, here's the deal, guys. If he believes never get out, then there's really two choices. And I don't think a Peter Malouk or anyone else can beat this. One is just go buy the S&P and reinvest your dividends. It's free. I mean, Schwab is making it free, whatever, 3 basis points today, 3 pennies on $100, right? I mean, that's a number so close to zero, it looks like free. Mm-hmm. So if his thing is, guys, you're going to fool yourselves, we're flawed as humans to keep it and grow it, and I've done the research, and if you can't have 10 million or 5 billion and give it to Ray Dalio or someone else, then here's what's actually best. And what's best is just buy, reinvest dividends, and you'll beat 99% of anyone over any 7-year period. Okay. So if that was his conclusion, I'd be like, yeah, that seems pretty good. Or if he said, no, you've got to have bonds in there, because during these 50%+ corrections, bonds help you not freak out, and they go up a little bit. They don't fully compensate for the fall, but they help you manage.
They cushion it.
So if you need to take some money out, take it out from the bonds because they're going to be growing, and don't touch the stocks. Like, if you believe that, then the answer is Vanguard's got a fund, a 60-40 split, rebalanced. It will do it for you for whatever, 15, 20 basis points. Like, if that's it, then cool. If he's really standing up for the little guy, then his solution is either get the S&P, reinvest your dividends, and you're done forever. Or if he believes in the stock bond split, then the answer is some super cheap Vanguard fund that does it all for you. And, you know, historically and probabilistically, paying 20 basis points, I think Peter Malouk's company charges 1.2%. I have no problem with charging fees, but if the business end of the solution is come in to my business or that I'm a partner of, and we'll do the best 60-40 split from you, I just think I call garbage on it and say you can just go get an off-the-shelf fund to do that for really inexpensive.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about at the same time, just an advisor. I do believe there is something about when you enter in that kind of advisory relationship where there is the idea that you're going to be holding on to something, whatever it is, for the long haul, and where you may get, cold feet during various times of market cycles and utilizing whatever money management technique you have, and the right thing to do may be one thing where your emotions are telling you something else. Oftentimes, as an individual investor, you know, you're better off having a few basis points paid to an advisor that may be able to help you navigate the process. In other words, it's better than self-medicating, is what I'm saying. And I don't know what that's exactly worth per se, but I somehow believe there is some benefit in that. Now, there are some advisory firms that are built solely on that, right? The whole new way of, oh, we're going to just put you in all these ETFs that are market-based, and we're just going to be here to hold your hand through all the different things. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm not sure what that's all about. But if there is some need for people to have, and a lot of people just don't understand money, you know, they don't understand anything about it, and they have an inability to understand it or learn it. It's the way it is. There's something to be said about that. But all right, so I get it. I understand.
But here's the thing, Andrew. If he came out and said, look, If you know yourself well enough, and you're like, look, if you can't stomach it through, you know, a 30, 40, 50%, you know, you're going to go in there and reach it out and do something stupid, then you need to have a serious conversation with someone who can protect you from doing something.
Right, and you shouldn't be invested in these areas. That's another point. You shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. I mean, you should get trained. You should understand. I mean, this is a huge part of what type of stability and stableness this person has in their future.
Right.
So, look, I manage people's money. I'm not saying, you know, shame on the industry. Like, it's an important industry, but if it's just like you absolutely cannot do it without us, we have the solution. I'm just like, you know, it's garbage. If he then said, look, and we know that one of the best things we can do is protect you from doing something stupid at the exact wrong time. That apps, and I'm saying to you, like, that's absolutely has value. Of course it does.
But let me ask you something, this RC. Which one of the ways that could be presented is going to bring in more money? Is it option A, the Tony Robbins pitch, or option B, the Tony Robbins pitch with extra commentary, like you're saying? Which one of those is going to bring in more money to his money management firm?
Well, of course.
Well, so there you go. There's your answer.
Yeah, I mean, I know the answer. Like, I mean,
all right. So, what are you gonna do?
He uses the word crash. I mean, I was listening to an interview. He uses the word crash to scare people, but then when he talks about the company he's a partnership of, he talks about, well, the market corrects. The market corrects. So on one hand, it crashes, but then on the other hand, when he's talking about the solution, it corrects.
Yeah, I get it.
It's garbage, man. Like, use the same word both ways. Like, guys, when it corrected in January 2016, this is what happened. Corrections happen, guys. But he didn't. He said the market crashed in January. And then later he talked about, yeah, the market has corrections.
So this is like politicians on one hand saying something is criminal if you do it. And if I do it, it's an indiscretion.
Yeah. It's like, is it crashing or correcting?
Yeah. Like, I hear you. Well, it depends on where. I get it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes.
All right. No, let's go to a topic that's less volatile. You talk about the most crowded trade in history. You recently talked about that in one of your, I believe, your podcasts. And you talk about, I thought, well, one of the things that was really interesting was how, and I've talked about this so many times, about when there are so many players. I describe it as being on a ship or on a boat. So when you have everybody going to the left side, or as we say it, us mariners, say at the port side of the boat, you have 100 people, everybody goes to the port side. What happens? It all leans over, right? And then all of a sudden, somebody realizes that this thing is starting to list or to tilt too much. So what do they do? They don't slowly go to the other side, which would be the starboard side, by the way. They don't go to the starboard side. They don't just say, oh, I'm going to tell you, looks like we'll leave. What do they do? They run like hell, don't they? And this is the equivalent of a crowded trade where you have everybody on one side of the boat. And then all of a sudden somebody says, oh my God, it's moving. And what happens? That everybody runs, not just a few people, everybody starts running to the other side, like penguins, you know, jumping into the water. One goes and then they all go very quickly. And all of a sudden now what happens? Well, you didn't sink on the left side. Now you just managed to sink on the right side.
Yeah.
So where are the crowded trades these days?
So when I wrote that there were three historic, and when I say historic, never before at this large number. So one was in copper, one was in oil, and one was in 10-year treasuries. So the oil one was West Texas Intermediate crude was about $54 a barrel. Right, up from 26 and change. Mm-hmm. And when it was at the 54, there had never been as large of a long futures position in WTIC ever.
Like, and that's right where Dennis Gartman actually put his number as well. Okay. Seriously.
So it's like, okay, wait a second. The way I looked at this, and prior to this happening, this just happened, prior to this, the longest futures long position in oil ever was in June of 2014 when oil was like $110. Okay. And then it went from 110 to 26 and change. So it's like, okay, is there anyone left who believes it's going to go higher? Like, this is just what my brain said was, I don't know. Now it could go higher, but it seems like everyone who's going is there. And of course they can open up more futures positions, right? Because that's just how it works. But I was like, man, this has just doubled. It's basically gone from 27 to 54. It's doubled.
Everybody is on the port side of the boat at this point.
And it is the largest in history long position. Okay, so that's one. At the same time, the largest long position ever in copper is going on. Okay, that's okay, interesting. So both of those, right, if oil goes higher and copper goes higher, that's inflationary. And at the same time, it's the biggest short position on treasury, 10-year treasuries ever, which is the same bet. It's the same bet, the price going lower, yields going higher. So at the same time, you have these three historic positions all basically betting the same thing, interest rates are going higher, right? I mean, I'm not saying in lockstep if oil goes higher and copper goes higher, it means absolutely we're going into reflation. But there seems to be some correlation between them. So it's like, okay, well, man, if they're wrong, those future positions, they have to sell back that buy. So they have to, in a way, kind of short to get liquid. And same thing with bonds. And everyone knows pretty much that Yellen's going to increase it another 0.25%. So that feels kind of already baked in. I mean, unless she comes out and says, oops, it's 50 basis points, then, but that didn't seem likely based on who she's been the last decade of her life. So that looked to me as the most crowded trade. Those three together were all betting on the same thing, which is higher yields.
And what is somebody to do to at that point? When you see commitment of traders reports, or you see even possibly if you want to look at something like the amount of shares outstanding of the SPY or pricing, what is someone supposed to do in that circumstance?
I mean, it depends who they are. First of all, if the first thing is possibly nothing. Like, I just read something by fill in the blank, you know, newsletter writer, and they're saying oil's going to $100. I'd be like, I'm going to skip that one. Okay. If someone is looking for trade setups or trade ideas to be contrarian, then it'd be like, you know what? Maybe the better trade is to go against oil or copper or 10-year treasuries, because, man, there's no one on that side. And it wouldn't take much to tip the boat to the starboard side. So it could be someone who is looking for setups.
I got you.
Or it could just be someone looking, how do I know if they're right or not? What's my filter? Well, the last time oil had its largest position ever, and I'm not saying oil's going to crash 50%, but the last time it happened, oil went from 110 to 27. I'm not doomsday. I'm simply saying, well, the last time we were in this situation, it didn't go higher. So, man, there's a lot of downward pressure right now.
You know, and it's also like, let me give another analogy for a second. It's like being in a car and you put your foot down on the gas pedal and you're going 80. Then you push down a little bit more and you're going 90. And then you get it down to the floor and you go, let's say 110. You push harder, it's not going anymore. Right?
Yeah, it's like you can swear and push harder and it's still not,
it's not going anywhere. It's just not going anywhere. So, you know, there's a natural limit or limiter, because when you get to that point of being at the wall, you know, or the floorboard in this case, there's just not much more. There's just not much more that you can squeeze out of something. Now, that doesn't mean that the brake is going to be applied immediately. It may just be that a little bit is taken off the gas. But still, yeah, that will probably be a proportionally larger move to the downside in the terms of speed on the car. So I agree with you that, you know, you have to look at those when there's incredible exuberance, high, tremendously high consumer confidence, possibly, or, you know, these, or the opposite is true also. The opposite is very true, which is if markets are seeing, you know, or a commodity or a price is seeing such downward action that it looks like it's just, you know, oh my God, this thing is going to go down forever. And everybody starts spitting out of it. And we look at these capitulation moments where you see volume spike up on those down days that, you mean, well, who's left to sell? The players that are going to be holding long are going to be holding long forever anyway. They're not moving. So now you have to look at, well, if there's nobody really left, it's just going to be on the list of the short side. And if they did in fact gather a lot of shorts, well, maybe this is a chance for an opportunity. Now I'm talking more trading, but still,
yeah,
it's, you know, whether you want to do it on a short-term time frame or on a long-term time frame, I think it's all the same. We have to end it here. RC Peck, fearlesswealth.com, host of the weekly podcast Fearless Wealth. We'll put all the information and links on the show notes for this episode. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Great stuff.
Yeah, you're great. Thanks so much.
All right, buddy. Be well. That's going to wrap it up. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. We'll have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks. And I think that there's going to be some good excitement that we'll be seeing in markets. I just have this sneaking feeling that volatility and ranges that we've been seeing that have been so flat for some time, if in fact they're unable to bring up a tax reform or tax cut in the near future. And depending on how we all react to the potential for a much greater level of tension between us, United States, and Russia, North Korea, and the Middle East, it could be a very interesting time ahead. So keep that in mind. Of course, also, I did a write-up on the wonky numbers, we called it, from the employment report last week over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Look on the right side, on the bottom right, says our latest thoughts. You'll see that. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the best way to find out what's going on a regular basis, because everything we do on the blog and the podcast and our thoughts and our commentary is posted there automatically, regularly. Also, you can listen to DH Unplugged each and every week, where myself and John C. Dvorak come to you with some of the latest news, some of the wacky news, and some of the interesting news that has a little bit of a twist to it. Make sure to listen to that podcast. I think you'd enjoy that. Otherwise, have a great week. I'll see you then.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.